Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler Magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. I still haven't scored a professional soccer goal, so I just should clarify it's a soccer goal we're talking about, not like field hockey or water polo, which means that Bobby Warshaw, my partner here, is still the only member of this podcast to have scored a professional soccer goal. Bobby, how does that feel? How does
it
make you feel?
It is the thing I'm most proud of in life, actually. When I meet girls at bars, that's what I tell them.
Yeah, no, obviously, if they don't know it already, just from like your reputation, you have to tell them. But otherwise, they might come up to you and be like, "Hey, so I hear you score goals." Anyway, Bobby, after that scintillating intro, I want to ask you this question. We just recorded an interview with a fellow named James Dorsey who covers Middle Eastern soccer, and I want you to put a number on what percentage of the conversation was actually about soccer for our listeners, just to prepare them for what they're about.
The soccer percentage was low, but like the fascinating percentage was high.
Yeah, it had a high fascinating percentage, but like we're talking single digits soccer talk here.
Single digits, yeah. Low single digits. Even when we asked soccer questions, we didn't really want soccer answers. We just like threw the word soccer in there so people wouldn't cancel the podcast. Yeah,
say soccer a lot. So that's coming up, and it's really about how Saudi Arabia is using soccer in its sort of Cold War like diplomacy negotiations pairings with Iran. And to me, that's fascinating, and I love these stories, and it's just incredibly interesting to talk about. And we also, I recorded an interview as well with a guy named Dermot Kavanaugh, who wrote a piece in issue 2 of Howler way long ago about a guy named Laurie Cunningham. Laurie Cunningham was the first black player to play for England at any level, the under-21 team back in 1977. He was also the first Brit to play for Real Madrid. And Kavanaugh thinks he was maybe the second black player to play for Real Madrid. So a very interesting story. Long story short, though, Kavanaugh is writing a book about this guy. A couple of years after writing like 400 words for the magazine, it's becoming a book. We're going to talk to him about Laurie Cunningham, really interesting figure. But before that, we're going to talk to James Dorsey about all kinds of stuff relating to Iran, Saudi Arabia, the sort of Cold War thing going on in the Middle East right now, and how soccer comes into that.
And it is the best. If you're confused about Middle Eastern politics, specifically like the quasi-semi war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, it's the best description you'll hear of that. Because I was confused, even though reading a dozen articles, and I thought James really did a nice job clarifying.
That's what he does. He's the author of MideastSoccer.blogspot.com, so you would expect nothing less. Okay, so we're about to wade into something that's even more convoluted and controversial, I guess, than whether or not Louis van Gaal should stay at Manchester United. That is the world of Middle East politics, and to do that, there's nobody better than to talk to James M. Dorsey. He's a senior fellow at the Roger Rottnam School of International Studies. He's also the author of a wonderful soccer blog called The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer. He's got a book coming out by the same name. Wow. Okay, we got a lot going on. James, I want to start here, okay? We're talking about something that's super, very complicated and very big. These are issues that go back generations, and we're going to probably be dealing with them for generations. But I want to start here. Recently, Saudi Arabia executed a bunch of, they say terrorists. They might be terrorists, but they included a religious leader named Nimr al-Nimr, and his execution really upset Iran. And what I'm gathering from this whole situation, and this is where I want to start, is that Iran actually poses a threat to Saudi Arabia, they feel, because Iran is actually perhaps the more liberal employs a more liberal political system than Saudi Arabia, which is interesting to American ears, I think, because we tend to think Iran is as conservative and as hardline religious and as right-wing in that sense as you can get. Can you unpack that and tell me if my initial take is correct?
Sure. Just up front, to be fair to the Saudis, among those executed were a fair number of people who had committed political violence. Sheikh Nimr, the Shiite leader, was not one of them. But what underlies the execution of Sheikh Nimr, at least the timing of it, is a fundamental rivalry that is almost existential, certainly from the point of view of the Saudi rulers, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the rivalry is about regional hegemony, but it's also about what constitutes Islamic government. So you have Saudi Arabia, which is an absolute monarchy, if not a dictatorship, that whose legitimacy rests in a very Puritan form of Islam. And opposing that is Iran, which, whatever you think of the country, does have elections, and there's many things to say about that elections, but what it means is it has a recognition of popular sovereignty. And there are checks and balances to some degree within the system. And that means that it constitutes an alternative form of Islamic government, which the al-Sauds, the rulers of the kingdom, see as a fundamental threat. But let me take this one step further, if I may, and that is that if you take a step back and look at what these two countries bring to the table, you have on the one hand Iran, a former empire, a very established identity, 80 million people. Granted, it's in disrepair, but it does have an industrial base. It has a large domestic market. It has a battle-hardened military. It has significant oil resources. And it's a very creative country. And opposed to that is a country with 25, 28 million people, totally dependent on oil, very little economic diversification, no history. Or it has a history, but certainly not one that matches that of Iran. And what that all of this means, that at the end of the day, once the sanctions against Iran are lifted, and it's had several years to recover from the effect of the sanctions, Saudi Arabia will not be able to compete. It will be a second fiddle power in the region.
So you know, I think that we need to take this to soccer, at least briefly, because this is ostensibly
sure.
a soccer podcast. And I think, you know, and there's so much more that I want to ask you about just the politics of the region. But in the meantime, Saudi Arabia, since, you know, just to bring people up to date, Saudi Arabia performed these executions. Iran took severe, issue with those executions. You know, Iranians stormed the Saudi embassy, and Iran said that it was expelling Saudi diplomats from Iran. And Saudi Arabia, in turn, turned around and has been exerting its influence on states that sort of share its ideological values to further isolate Iran. And part of the way they've done this is through soccer diplomacy, I guess you could say. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, to paint the larger picture, hardliners in Iran, following the execution, stormed the Saudi embassy in Tehran. In response, Saudi Arabia broke off diplomatic relations.
Oh, right. Okay.
5 or 6 of the most prominent Saudi football clubs, soccer clubs, who are playing in the Asian Championship League and will be playing against Iranian counterparts, declared that they would not play on Iranian soil because it was not safe and because Iran was the enemy. And they've said that they would ask the regional confederation, the Asian Football Confederation, to move those games, those qualifying games, to a neutral venue. You've got to keep in mind that soccer in Saudi Arabia is a very tight, politically tightly controlled sport. Many, not all of the clubs are managed by members of the ruling family. So the decision not to play in Iran effectively is part of the government's effort to internationally isolate Iran, to strengthen the hardliners in advance of crucial elections next month, both for parliament as well as for the council that elects the country's spiritual leader, and to delay, if not disrupt, implementation of the nuclear agreement.
So let me jump in and just ask you a couple questions to try to unpack that a little bit. Obviously, it would seem unsafe. I think that if the U.S. embassy had been stormed, we wouldn't probably be sending 5 or 6 club teams to play in stadiums in Iran. But at the same time, the irony is that the provocation for the storming of that embassy was the execution of this religious leader. And so, you could say that, it looks to me like Saudi Arabia sort of engineered this situation in order to create a crisis. I guess I'd like you to just say whether you think that's true or not, because I'm not totally on firm ground here when I talk about these issues. But I also think there's an interesting aspect here which you brought up, which is the election of the spiritual council in Iran. Is Saudi Arabia, in your view, doing all this in order to try to keep those that spiritual council, on the conservative arc that it's been on for the last 35-30 years? Or would they like to see, I guess what you're saying is they don't want to see a democratization or a further democratization of Iranian society. They want to keep it a bit of a religious, less secular state.
Several things. One, there's no doubt in my mind that this was a deliberately and thought through act with the execution of Sheikh Nimr. What I don't think that the Saudis realized is that you have a situation that's very similar to post immediately after 9/11. After 9/11, Saudi Arabia, for the first time, was put under very close scrutiny, because everybody was asking themselves, why are the majority of the perpetrators of 9/11 Saudi nationals? The same thing is happening now again. Saudi Arabia is under the loop, and they don't feel comfortable about it. That's one. Second of all, it's not about more democracy or not more democracy, or in a sense it is, but it's about if Iran is an illiberal democracy, whatever form of democracy, what that means is you can have Islamic government in which people have something to say rather than an absolute dictatorship. And that is a fundamental threat to the regime in Saudi Arabia. The last thing is, sure, you're right. The taking of the embassy doesn't inspire confidence. The Saudis know very well that, as do others, that there's a power struggle going on in Iran. There's, on the one hand, Rouhani, who's trying to return Iran to the international fold, and there are the hardliners with their own vested interests who see a return, a liberalization in Iran of whatever kind, as a threat to those vested interests. What Saudi Arabia is trying to do is, both in terms of the parliamentary election, because this is going to be a litmus test for President Rouhani, as well as in the council that elects a spiritual leader, they want to see hardliners, because hardliners, if the Saudis get it their way, are going to mess it up or complicate Iran's return. And the longer it takes for Iran to return to the international community, and the longer it takes to rehabilitate its economy, the better it is for the Saudis.
Can I ask you this, James? I guess one thing that strikes me is that if Iran were to return to the international community as a full member and sort of participate in those institutions, it might lead to the lessening of what I guess I look at as sort of a Cold War third party skirmishes that are happening in Syria and in Iraq. And I guess my question for you is that seems like it would probably be a threat to Saudi Arabia, because you know, they're able to sort of say, look, we have these enemies. We have these people who are, you know, fighting in countries adjacent to us. We need to continue our policies, you know, in order to keep them at bay. But if those conflicts were to lessen, then citizens of Saudi Arabia or people who live there might start to look a little bit more closely at its own government.
Well, I think it's more complex than that. With other words, Iran's return to the international fold means that Iran will be involved, certainly in those situations where it has influence or is involved, in trying to resolve conflicts, for example, Syria or Yemen. Now, that's the sort of straight line analysis, and it's correct. But what you're going to see over in the coming period is that Iran and Saudi Arabia are not going to go to war against each other. They're going to fight. They're already fighting proxy wars in places like Syria and Yemen, and those proxy wars are going to intensify and probably expand. To give you one example, Iran's probably going to support Shiites in the oil-rich eastern province of Saudi Arabia in their demands for equal rights because they're discriminated against. By the same token, Saudi Arabia is already playing games with an Arab population in the oil-rich province of Iran. So on the one hand, you're going to get Iranian cooperation, but on the other hand, you're going to get intensified and expanding conflict.
James.
Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
George, can I interject with a soccer question, which I feel bad because this is about a good an explanation of the Iran-Saudi troubles I've heard. But from a soccer standpoint, how do the players and the fans feel and the locals feel about soccer being brought into this? Do they understand? Are they so nationalist that they want their countries to take a stand, or are they upset from a sporting perspective?
No, I think what you've got to keep in mind is that all foreign policy and what you do also has strong domestic implications and reasons. So what the execution of Sheikh Nimr has done is it's whipped up national fervor. So a majority of Saudis look at the Iranians as the devil.
So they're okay with soccer being brought into it.
And they don't have a problem with that.
Okay,
another soccer question, if you can.
And that's true for the Iranians too.
Another soccer question, if you can believe it, James. How does this affect the AFC, and what is their involvement in this? I know that, you know, you mentioned in your story the president of the AFC, Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa, is sort of, you know, trying to take control of FIFA or maybe become the president of FIFA. You know, how does he navigate this? Is there even the possibility that this could be navigated fairly or safely, or is this just designed to sort of throw his bid to become head of FIFA out of whack?
No, I mean, the Saudis actually support Salman as head of the in the electoral campaign for the FIFA presidency, so they're not trying to in any way undercut him, but. He is a member of the Bahrain ruling family. The Bahrain is the only Gulf country that followed Saudi Arabia in breaking off diplomatic relations with Iran. And it is always denied that the popular revolt that took place in 2011 and everything that's happened since has been on the grounds of domestic discontent. The Bahrainis have always asserted that this was Iranian interference. And it was with the help of Saudi troops that popular revolt was suppressed, and those Saudi troops are till today in Bahrain. So, with other words, Bahrain doesn't do anything that Saudi Arabia doesn't agree to. And that puts Sheikh Salman in a very difficult position. Because on the one hand, if he has to decide on moving these games, he's going to have to do that in line with the regulations and rules of the Asian Football Confederation. And the Iranians are going to fight this nail in the tooth. But on the other hand, if he doesn't comply with the Saudis, it puts the Bahrainis and his own family in a very difficult position. So it's going to be very interesting to see how he handles this.
James, within the AFC, the Asian Football Confederation, is there a divide, and how does it play out, I guess, between Shiite countries and largely Sunni countries? I assume that, I guess from a quick tally in my head, I think Sunni countries would outnumber Shiite countries?
By any measure, yes.
Okay, so does that play out in any practical way in AFC politics?
Well, what it means is that the executive committee of the AFC is going to be probably very pro-Saudi. It's not just simply a question of Sunni Shiite, but of the Saudis wage enormous influence. They've had the single largest dedicated public diplomacy campaign in post-World War II history, spending up to $100 billion on soft power. That's leaving aside investment, government-to-government relations, development aid. So countries like Malaysia, probably Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, those including the three largest Muslim population countries in the world, are not going to vote against the Saudis.
I guess here's a final question for you, and it's a pure politics and sort of history question. Not much soccer here, but I hope you'll indulge me. When I think about this conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, two sort of other frameworks, I guess, for thinking about this come to mind, and I'm wondering if you can tell me where those comparisons are accurate and where they fall apart, or what might be useful about them. One is, the centuries-long schism between Protestants and Catholics in Europe that caused so many wars and so much bloodshed. Another is the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the second half of the 20th century. Where might those comparisons be worthwhile, and where are they sort of useless for us?
I think they both hink. First of all, the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, even if though the Saudis portray it or project it in sectarian terms, has nothing to do with religion. This is a pure power struggle. And from the Saudi perspective, a struggle for existence. They just see it as in their interest to emphasize the sectarian character, the sectarian aspect of it, but the sectarian aspect is not what drives it. Where I think that the analogy with the Cold War hinks is that the struggle between the United States of the West and the Soviet Union was an ideological struggle, and largely political and power. There was nothing existential in it. As such, it was not that if one won, the legitimacy of the other would by definition drop.
But the U.S. did treat communism as it might a religion, especially in the early days. They were worried about it sort of infecting American citizens, people becoming sort of really tied to this ideology in the way that they might a religion.
Sure.
They fought it that way, right?
Sure, but I think. I think you've got to make one distinction. One is the way the government wishes in whatever conflict to project the conflict, because it believes that that's the way that's the way it's going to win that conflict, that's what's going to persuade people to back it, and so on. On the other side, you have just simply taking a step back and analytically looking at it, and that may be a different picture from what the way the government projects it. And what I'm saying is, sure, that's the way the U.S. government over the years projected the struggle with the Soviet Union, but it was really a struggle about hegemony, a struggle about influence across the globe, much more than that. A majority of the U.S. population was going to turn communist because they, you know, on the assumption that they didn't have a stake in the system. Most Americans do have a stake in the system.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Listen, I really appreciate you coming on. I want to just tell our listeners that if you liked the soccer aspects of this, there's so much more of it at your website, middysoccer.blogspot.com. And if you enjoyed the political part of it, then I can tell you that your writing is much more lucid and effective at conveying these ideas than my formulations of them have been. So either way, I would encourage you to go check out MideastSoccer.blogspot.com, the turbulent world of Mideast soccer. James Dorsey, thank you so much for joining.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
I'm joined now by Dermot Kavanaugh. Dermot, you are the you're the sports pictures editor at the Sunday Times in London, and you more relevant for us, you wrote a piece for the second issue of Howler a couple of years ago now about a guy named Laurie Cunningham. And you know, I think it may be overstating it to call Laurie Cunningham the UK's Jackie Robinson, but it's not too much of an overstatement. Can you tell us about why you wrote about him back then?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm interested in, he was one of the first black footballers to play for England to get a cap. He was the first senior black player. He played for the under-21s in 1977. And then a year later, there was a player called Viv Anderson. But Cunningham was sort of at the forefront of black players getting capped, basically, by England. But he was also the very famous team over here called West Bromwich Albion, who in the late 70s, had three black players in their team who were nicknamed the Three Degrees. And they had a huge impact and were very important in the advancement of black footballers in this country. So that's probably why you think he's similar to Jackie Robinson.
But, comparison, right? But yeah. You know, I think it's a little more complicated than that. And you know, beyond West Brom and the Three Degrees, he went on to have a pretty amazing career. I mean, playing for Real Madrid in the first...
Well, he was the first British player to play for Real Madrid, and I think their second black player. So that was in 1979. So going to sort of Madrid post-Franco Spain, you know, Franco had only been dead 3 or 4 years, was quite an achievement. And he went there without much support, without any agents or management. So he was pretty much on his own for the first few months. He was with his girlfriend, but he had a fantastic first season. They won the double, they won the league and the cup, and got to the European Cup final in 1981 as well, which they lost to Liverpool. But yeah, he was a real sort of groundbreaker in that sense. But he's been largely, I wouldn't say forgotten, but his name isn't that well known, isn't as well known as it should have been for somebody who played for Real Madrid in England. Certainly over here, he's become a little bit of a forgotten name, so I wanted to sort of get him better known, basically.
Well, he's forgotten partly because he was injured, you know, after that first season. He scored 16 goals in that first season for Madrid, which is a pretty decent number. But then he went out on loan to teams like Manchester United and Wimbledon, and sort of, you know, had a tragic end to his life when he was only 33 years old, died in a car accident. So that may be...
A car crash, yeah.
Right.
And also in those days... football, European football wasn't as well covered in the UK as it is now. I mean, you only heard games on the radio, really, and maybe then only one game would be on the radio live if an English team was featured. So it was a bit of an unknown quantity to most people, although obviously Real Madrid were world famous, but there just wasn't the coverage. And like you say, he got injured. He had two very bad injuries, a toe injury and then a knee, his left knee, required two operations, and it never quite healed properly, so he lost his defining feature, which was his pace, so he had to adapt his game, hence the loan spell where Real Madrid loaned him out to various clubs. Ultimately, I think they got frustrated with him and bought in another player and he was loaned out. So, yeah, but like I say, played for Man United.
There are a few other strokes in his career that are interesting. I mean, sort of overlooked by Arsenal after he had a tryout. He got picked up by Leighton Orient, and the manager there said something to the effect of, you know, he could cross the ball accurately with both feet, which is something I had never seen before. Quote you had in the piece. I guess I'm curious, you know, okay, first cap in 1977, or first appearance for an England team, that was the under-21 team in 77. 78 with West Brom, he goes to Spain and beats Mario Kempis's Valencia and sort of plays him out of the park, as you tell it. And that's, I assume that's what got him noticed by Real Madrid. And then the next year, 79, joins Madrid. That's an amazing 3-year stretch. I'm curious, why do you think it took so long? You know, he comes from Jamaican parents who are living in the UK, and you know, London has a huge Caribbean population. Why do you think it took so long for a black player to break into the England squad?
It was, I mean, like you said, Orient was a very, I mean, if he hadn't been Orient, he might not have progressed beyond there, because the manager there, George Petchy, was very tolerant of him. His poor punctuality and just sort of various sort of indisciplines, and he stuck with him and was convinced that he could play for England. He thought he was one of the best players, young players in the country. So, I mean, the prevailing, the orthodox sort of coaching view at the time, which was holding back a lot of black players and a lot of black teenagers who weren't getting beyond schoolboy, was that black players somehow were cowardly or lacked on fibre, and were no good when the weather got colder and it got dark. So they were sort of luxuries in a way. They were skillful, they were fancy dance, but when it got cold and wet, they went missing, which of course was nonsense. But there seemed to be this management sort of view that you couldn't fully trust, or somehow black footballers weren't totally professional. Not like the traditional hard, you know, physical English footballer, which certainly Cunningham wasn't that. He was more balanced and nuanced than that. And the fact that he could jump out of tackles, some managers took that as cowardice, about he was afraid to get caught in the tackle. But the way he viewed the game was that if I can get the ball and jump out of the tackle, then I can pick the ball up afterwards, and I'm not getting injured. So it was just a conflict of approaches as much as anything. But also there was a racial element, you know, that they didn't like them players taking the place of our players, if you want to put it in those sort of bold terms. Yeah.
Well, I think there seems to be a strain of distrust among sort of hardcore old school English fans of players, you know, no matter the race, who are skillful and maybe maybe more cerebral than they're used to, and you know, there's a whole line of players like that who have sort of been ostracized or you know, sort of looked down upon in England. I think Letizia would be an example, right?
You know, definitely. So they're sort of almost that they're half-hearted, you know, because they're not physical enough, and the definition certainly after the World Cup in '66. The definition of a good pro was someone who'd go in, you know, and come back with scars on their face, or, you know, or a broken collarbone, who'd sort of shown they'd been in a battle. And it was that very sort of English tradition of showing your bruises and your cuts to show that you were a good pro. Whereas if you came off and you hadn't fouled someone and been fouled, it was like, well, you're not fully committed to the team. And that view is still very prominent in certainly lower league football over here, and you're right. Yeah, that's seen as a luxury, as you know, or not consistent enough. Yeah, you want someone. I think they'd rather have a player who was getting 7 out of 10 every game than someone who's getting 10 out of 10 and then 5 out of 10. The whole thing about this being a professional, a good pro, was the term that was always used. Was you had to be physical, aggressive, and not outstanding, but consistently, you know, good and hard-working. Effort, basically. It's like, you know, effort in the rain and the mud was seen as a great quality, rather than balance and grace. Yeah.
So let's talk about the book you're writing, because that's the reason we're talking right now. You wrote this piece for us. It was 400 words. I wish we could expand it. Maybe we'll get to run the excerpt when you're finished. But you are currently working on a project to bring this to book form, and you have a project up
at
unbound.co.uk. If people go there and search Laurie Cunningham, that's L-A-U-R-I-E Cunningham, they can find it, and it's a great project. I think there's so much more to his story than what we were able to publish in the magazine. And tell me what it was about his story that really made you think it needed to be a book.
Well, apart from the footballing success and the highs and lows of that, we touched upon with the England, one of the first to play for England, the Real Madrid, and the whole impact of the 3 degrees. It's a story about London, but also a story about youth culture. He was heavily into soul music, and in the early 70s, around about the same time, just before punk rock broke in London, there was a big underground soul movement in London itself. It was based around fashion and dancing and nightclubs, but a very early sort of do-it-yourself backroom of a pub sort of scene. And he was one of the leading figures in that. He was a very good dancer, and there's a couple of clubs that were very influential, which led on to some quite well-known DJs' careers where they started. And he was part of this London clique of mostly black, second-generation Caribbean teenagers who were into this sort of cutting-edge, mostly American, imported American funk music, which you couldn't get in London at the time. You could only get it from two or three shops or suppliers in the West End of London. So he was at the forefront of that, so I found that fascinating. And also they dressed fantastically in bespoke suits, hats, and two-tone shoes. This whole sort of style and youth culture element. So combining that with the football, I think it made him quite a unique personality, because most footballers, or a lot of footballers, are quite one-dimensional or will be fairly conservative, whereas he was fashion-wise, style-wise, a bit like his football. He was right at the forefront and was very open to various other interests, things like design, fashion, and music.
Players as being on the cultural avant-garde by any means. There's a great photo in the piece we ran of him wearing this amazing suit with a fat tie, and just but the pose he was striking was just so confident and so
like a dancer's pose. Yeah. Well, that look, which ran about 1974-75, was called the Great Gatsby look, because it was about the time that Robert Redford film came out, the Gatsby film, and that was a big influence on the Soul Boys, that sort of 20s, 30s style suit. But he had that made by a tailor in East London, and that's how he would dress, not only to go out, but there was a great story I was told by when he was at Orient. He went to a reserve team game at Southend. Now, Southend is a sort of coastal resort, about the nearest one to London, but it's very close to the East End as well. So it's a very working class, seaside resort, a bit like Coney Island or something, I suppose. He turned up, so all the South End players were in their blazers and ties, as you'd expect. And he turned up in a suit like that with a silver top cane, an eye patch, and a hat. He thought someone doing that at the age of 17, 18 has got to have something about them. I just love that whole idea of that side of his personality as well. But again, the other appealing element is that he's quite an introverted figure. He's not, from his playing ways, you actually think he'd be this extrovert, loud figure in the changing room, but he seemed quite introverted and quiet in a way, unless, with his inner circumstances, but very expressive on the football field and very expressive on the dance floor. So, again, that's another interesting element, the difference between his outward appearance and what he was like.
Man, I'm so excited about the book.
From his friends and his...
Sorry, I just want to let people know they can go and back it at unbound.co.uk.
Yeah, that's it. It's being crowdfunded, so you can pledge. There's various levels. You could, from £10 to £20 to a bit more, where you get rewards like limited edition prints, photographs, that type of thing. So, have a look. I mean, there's a little short video of me talking about him as well. So, I think it covers most of those, what I find interesting and why I find him interesting.
Yeah. Great. And there's also a Twitter account. It's Different Class, which is the name of the book, but different, the I is actually a numeral one. So it's at Different Class.
Yeah.
And people can go and see updates there and follow news about the book.
Yeah, and that was an expression that he used. If he approved of something, he said it was different class, so hence, you know, the title.
All right, Dermot Kavanaugh, you too are of a different class. I appreciate you coming on to Dummy, and I wish you luck with the book. I hope we have lots of listeners
who
can back it.
Thanks very much.
Okay, Bobby, I feel bad because, you know, I recorded the interview with Dermot myself, and then I totally hogged the conversation because I had just so many questions for James. So I want to give you a chance to give us like an extra long, if you want.
Well, one thing, George, one thing people should know about you when it comes to like politics and like non-soccer events is you guys, I once asked George what book he was reading, and it's basically his question was like, well, what hour of the day? George happens to read like two or three books at a time at all times. Well, so these non-soccer conversations can really get him fired up.
I get fired up, and you know, and to be honest, I'm reading a book, but I'm also listening to a book. So that's it's I'm cheating a little bit, you know, because when I'm in the shower, I got a little speaker, you know, when I'm shaving, when I'm washing the dishes, I consider that reading, but I'm not reading anything.
I get it. No waste of time in life, man.
Dude, yeah, I mean, come on.
I get it.
So anyway, that's what's happening. But we're going to do a Tiki Talker right now on whatever you want to talk about, Bobby. This is your time. This is your
my Tiki Talker. This is like one of like my favorite events of the year is when the Ballon d'Or comes out. And I actually don't care about the World Player of the Year award because that's voted on by like the big time coaches and managers. What you might not know is that Best 11 that you see that's like awarded right after the World Player of the Year is actually voted on by players throughout the world. Sometime in early winter, maybe late fall, your team captain gets mailed from FIFA, you know, 20 pamphlets, and you fill out this. It's literally just like a sheet of paper, and it says, who is your, and it's fancy, it's gold, it's like FIFA stylish, of course, but it basically says, who do you think were the best 11 players this year? And of the 20, maybe 12, 10 or 12 turn it in, and of those 10 and 12, I'd say on universal end that the 5 years I've been playing professional, I don't think one time I've put someone who wasn't – I think this year my list was Chris Seitz in goal, Stephen Keel at center back, Hercules Gomez at forward. And I just wonder, like, how do they actually – I suppose, you know, there's enough people to take it seriously. Even still, like, my other teammates, you know, one person puts Lionel Messi and somebody else will put Drogba. And I had some African guys on my team who goes, no, African best player in the world. I vote for Africans and only Africans. And that's kind of, so whenever this best 11 comes out, I'm like, how do they decide this? You know, they have thousands of players from around the world vote on it. And I just wonder, like, if they actually release the real list or just the list that is the least weird.
Bobby, were you in that Idris Elba movie recently that was set in West Africa? Because that was an excellent.
That was?
Impression. Yeah, that was just fantastic.
I've had.
Be a child soldier in like Ivory Coast.
Well, you know what I know? Whoa, that's really going somewhere. But, you know, I've had enough Africans on my teams now, and it's almost fun to have Africans on your team because they're so loud and boisterous. They're always screaming across the locker room at each other. So I feel like I can, like, do their voice as well now. Oh, whereas, you know, Hispanic guys are a little quieter. I can't get their voices down.
You know what? I'm not going to ask you to do that impression.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm just going to imagine what that could be. Okay, so my Tiki Talker is from this week's Goalmouth newsletter. The Goalmouth, if you haven't heard me harping on about this in previous episodes, is our daily email newsletter sent out by Brooks Peck of Dirty Tackle in association with Howler. It's so good. It's really, really funny. And this week, without the Goalmouth, I would not have learned of this guy, Demi de Zou. Well, okay, so it's spelled Demi de Zeeuw. So I would pronounce that Demi de Zeeuw, but maybe it's Demi de Zeeuw or something like that. I don't speak Dutch. So anyway, this guy was a former, you know, Dutch player, and now he runs this like little soccer, like lifestyle apparel and whatever company. And he put this, I guess he's like 8 million followers on Instagram, and he put this video on Facebook of after he posted on Instagram, his phone notifications. He's on the lock screen, right, before you put in the little code to unlock your phone. And it's just like, it's just scrolling. And the whole video takes like, let me see, how long is this video? Oh my God, it's 38 seconds of continuous scrolling. Like, imagine the fastest movie credits you've ever seen. And it's just like, incredible, like, it just doesn't stop for 38 seconds. It's crazy. So, made me really glad that, you know, dummy has a modest number of listeners, because otherwise my phone would just be blowing up all the time and it would be unbearable and my life would suck. So thank you everybody for not clamoring to like all of Howler's Facebook and Instagram posts, because that would just make my life terrible. But this was really amazing. So if you want to learn about things like this that really enrich your life and make it better, you should go sign up for the Goal Mouth. It's you can go and do it by going to our Facebook or our website. Actually, the Facebook page is the best place to do it. Go to facebook.com/whatahowler. You can go sign up for our email newsletter, including the Goal Mouth. You should also, while you're at it, sign up for the bulletin, which comes out on Fridays. It's also really good. But yeah, if you want to see what this is like to have the phone of a famous person on your dinner table, it's pretty amazing. Bobby, I assume, like, after you go out to the bar and meet these women who know you've scored goals, like, this is sort of what happens to your phone.
This is exactly what happens.
I feel bad for you.
Minus everything that you just described.
Oh, okay. yeah, and if you had like a smartphone, then it probably would. But you have one of those flip phones, right?
I do, yeah. So rocking that flip phone game.
A beeper? Very nice. Well, listen, I don't know if you can hear that in the background, but my little puppy has been in her crate for like an hour or two now. And she's like, hear that? Can you hear it?
Yeah.
She probably needs to go pee in the backyard or something. So I'm going to let you go, man.
Okay.
This was fun. Thanks for participating. Yeah. I know that I hogged the mic this week.
But no, you did great, dude. You did really well at that Dorsey interview.
That's what I wanted to hear. Thanks, man. Okay, let's do the credits real quick. I want to thank, obviously, James Dorsey and Dermot Kavanaugh for coming on. Bobby, thank you for your time. And I really appreciate you being the new Danny, if I can say that. I hope I'm not pissing off Danny. But, you know, you're the new Danny in my heart and on this podcast. I also want to thank our producers, Ryan Katniss and Wesper Dine. They get help from Nick Jansen and Faisal Sikdar. Faisal is the one who reached out to James Dorsey and set that interview up, so I'm very grateful. What else? You should follow Howler on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're at WhatAHowler. Facebook, as I said, is just facebook.com/WhatAHowler. We are getting ready to bring out the next issue. I mean, you know, in like a month or month and a half. So you should go and get a subscription to Howler. You can do that at shop.howlermagazine.com. Till then, I want to remind you, well, my name is George Grace, you should say that, but I also want to remind you that when you listen to Dummy, Bobby, you know what the saying is? You will never
listen. You never listen alone.
Listen alone. It's kind of true. Unless you are alone. But we're with you, so that's why it's not. That's why it's true. So, anyway, my puppy wants to be let out. Everyone, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week.